it might just be mud to some people or dirt or soil, but actually there's a lot more going on in that root zone, in that area, that's very, very important.
Welcome to the Underground Podcast. I'm Kate, the gardener guru, horticultural consultant, and writer and presenter on all things gardening.
And I'm Phil, co-founder of Rytobara, a creative marketing agency for the home and garden sectors. Join us in conversation with those people shaping the UK's garden care industry.
So, without further ado,
let's get down and dirty.
Hi there, Kate.
Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you very much. Here we are for another episode of The Underground.
Absolutely. And I'm really looking forward to this one because we're going back to kind of our more traditional roots with the podcast, and we're going to be looking at peat-free.
Absolutely. It's something that we've covered quite a lot in the past, but I think there's always room for more voices to be heard.
Especially because there's still no peat ban. It's still not being legislated against. So it keeps being pushed back and back and back. So I think it's still really pertinent that we talk to people very much involved in the peat-free world.
And we are working on, as we've mentioned in the past, our special all about peat-free.
Yeah.
And so this is just helps to add further voices and input into that debate, really.
Absolutely. And do you want to just talk about who we've got on today's episode, Phil?
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking with Dan Durston from Durston's. I think the clue is in the name there. and also Simon Blackhurst, who is a consultant who's been working with Durston's on their implementation of peat-free compost.
That's right. And so, he's also been working in growing media for quite a long time. That seems to be his passion. And Durston's is a very old family business. So I'm really looking forward to hearing all about their stories.
Yeah. So Durston's was actually a peat producing company. So actually seeing that transition from having been a peat producing company to this new era of peat free is really interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to be fascinated by the story, by the journey. We do love a journey word. So yeah, it's not something that's going away. People are still kind of fighting against it. So it'd be really good to hear people who are really at the coalface, as it were. I want to hear what they have to say. So looking forward to this one.
And I think for people actually within the industry, I think it'll be interesting to find out what the challenges are that Dan and Simon are facing, but also what educational challenges are needed as well or around.
It's interesting, isn't it, Phil? Because probably this time last year, I would have just thought we wouldn't be talking about this because I'd have thought the ban would have come into place, legislation would have been there. And it's not happening. And education is still really, really needed. The RHS are really doing a lot, but not everybody listens to the RHS. So I think it is going to be a bit more down to the companies, the garden centres, everybody that works within the industry to come together. So
I totally agree, Kate. So why don't we get Dan and Simon on and we can hear what they have to say.
So this morning, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by Dan Durston and Simon Blackhurst. So good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on. So I'm going to kick off. And Dan, I'd like to ask you. So Durston is your surname. It's your family business based in Somerset and is over 150 years old. So can you tell us a bit about this?
Yes, I can. 1860, my great-great-great-grandfather moved to Sharpham, where he dug some peat by hand for burning and sold to the local towns via horse and cart.
Good.
Moving on 100 years, not a lot changed really, apart from it different generations, and instead of a horse and cart, they had a small lorry.
Right.
Okay.
And in 1960, horticulture became known for using peat as a growing media.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather at the time bought in German machinery to dig peat mechanically, and we sold peat to other growing media manufacturers so that they could use it in their bags.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, my grandfather and my grandmother were hobby farmers. They had a small dairy herd. Okay. And that was sold in 1973. Okay. So that they could concentrate more on manufacturing and harvesting peat to sell.
Right.
And in 1989, when my grandfather retired, my dad and my uncle decided that they would like to install their own factory and manufacture their own compost. And they produced 1,000 pallets in their first season.
Wow.
moving on to 2010, we installed our first ever fully automatic bagging plant, okay. Where you don't touch the bag at all. You put the rolls of film on at one end and you take the pallets off at the other end. And then we had COVID when we were working silly hours. I was doing my day job sort of 8 till 4 and then going home for something to eat and coming back in to work in the factory until midnight, working weekends because there was nothing else to do and lots of pallets of compost to make. Not a day off for 4 months. So the first thing we did after COVID was invest in a secondary production line, because we realized our vulnerability with only having one line. Moving on, we've got further expansion plans. So this summer we installed our third fully automatic production line. Yeah, we now have the capability of producing 6,000 pallets in a week.
Right. Goodness. Can I ask how big is the farm? How big is your land?
Well, we've got 150 acres of peatland and exhausted peatland, factory, etc.
So did you always see yourself as joining the family business, or did you have other dreams? Tell us a bit about you, Dan.
Well, mentally, I was going to be a professional sportsman, but that didn't happen. But I've always had a very passionate interest in the family business, and right. I've been coming here, visiting, and helping out for over 40 years. Right. Just as a child in school holidays, coming down and helping stroke getting in the way. It was something I've always loved to do. And after school, I went to university and I dropped out after a short period. It wasn't for me.
Right.
I asked my dad if he had any jobs going, and he said no. Fast forward a year, there was a vacancy, so he offered me a job working in the factory as a forklift driver, starting at the bottom as it should be. And I progressed working in the factory over 18 years until I became factory manager because I was the most experienced at the time. Okay. Then 2016, there was a territory vacancy in sales. So I was doing 3 or 4 days a week in the factory and 2 days a week on the road.
Right.
And then later on that year, there was a vacancy as national sales manager. And I put myself forward for that. And I've been here in this position ever since.
Goodness. So no actual real total nepotism. You started from the bottom and you had to apply for those jobs and get them. So that's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know if it's unusual, but I'm proud of how it was. And I wasn't, slotted in at the top, in a managerial role from the start. I do know the business completely inside out. I'm very grateful for that, for having the knowledge that I have now.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm really interested in the land that you've got, Dan. So, can you just describe some of that peatland that your family's been working on for us?
It's lowland, inland peat land, if you like. Okay. It was drained by the monks of Glastonbury Abbey many, many years ago. There has been, not currently, but there has been lots of small manufacturers of peat in the same area that we're at now for all that time.
So can I just rewind a little bit? Yeah, drained by the monks of Glastonbury Abbey.
Yes. Yeah,
that's fascinating.
Many, many years ago, this was known as the ancient Isle of Avalon.
Oh,
it was all flooded area. And until it was drained, it was just completely useless land. Right. I can't be completely accurate, but my great-grandfather, I think, used to go to school on a boat.
Wow.
Fantastic. So we're not talking about kind of the peatland habitat that is kind of wetlands that's rich with wildlife and bird life. We're talking about peatland, that habitat that was used, that was drained many, many years ago before your company, you know, came into effect. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right. It's not like your company came along in the 60s and kind of devastated this landscape, because already it had been used a lot, hadn't it? So it wasn't kind of this beautiful, pretty peatland that's what people automatically assume. It was already a worked land.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, we've always harvested our peat in a sympathetic way, and we've always restored the bogs thereafter to produce wetlands and fishing lakes and haven for nature. Because, you know, when we started excavating, they were just very low-level grazing land. And what we left behind is a habitat for nature and wildlife everywhere.
Lovely.
Okay. Right. That's really important, isn't it, I think? And so moving fast forward now, your company's now making that transition to peat-free. What inspired you to do that, and what's your passion about the sustainability of peat-free?
As a business, we've always had an ethos: if we're going to do something, then we want to do it well. And obviously there's been peat debate ever since the mid-90s, I would say. And we launched our first ever earth-friendly range in mid-90s with three products using all sorts of weird and wonderful ingredients, but heavily coir-based.
Right.
And it was just ahead of its time. So we tried that for about 3 or 4 years and dropped it. And obviously with the legislations going through in Parliament now, and for the last few years, we felt it was the right time to get ahead of the game. And with Simon's help, we've developed a range of products with materials that we know work. And we're very, very proud of our quality of our peat-free.
Brilliant. So you mentioned Simon there. So this sounds like a good time to bring you in, Simon. Simon, can you just tell us a little bit about how you became involved with Durston's?
Yeah, so I used to work for Board na Mearna, which was the Irish Board of Peat. And so many years ago, I was working on peat-free before they stopped harvesting the peat. So Board na Mearna was the biggest exporter, essentially, to all the manufacturers of Irish peat. And they, when I joined their company, they wanted to move into peat-free because they knew they were going to stop harvesting from the bark, so they were going to start turning their power plants to alternative uses. So I spent a number of years looking at formulations, raw materials, different combinations, all those bits and bobs to get a good peat-free range together. And we worked with most of the major multiples and B&Q and the likes. And then Board na Mearna exited peat and decided that they also weren't going to continue with horticulture in terms of their portfolio.
Okay.
So our site was closed down and sold to another company. And at that point, we were all made redundant. And I wanted to use all the information that I'd got from horticulture via Board na Mearna to help others, because I knew that peat-free was a challenge. You know, I'd been working on it for a good long number of years and having all those issues and was still active within the Growing Media Association, Horticultural Trace, you know, all of those bodies. And I just wanted to disseminate as much information as I possibly could to help people grow, because grow plants, because that's my passion.
Right.
Dan and I had met many a time at Growing Media Association meetings, never really got, you know, overly friendly or anything. But then as I was an independent and Dan was looking for their future of peat-free, we got in touch and yeah, I suppose the rest, they say, is history. So we've been sort of working together for at least 2 years now on their ranges and everything from research and development through to production, down skills. And yeah, I think we have made exceptional products that are outperforming others on the market. Right. So we're both very proud, to be fair. Durston's from their point of view, and obviously from my point of view, the technical side of things, because I'm a techie geek, basically, in terms of growing media. That's where my brain sits.
Were you always into horticulture, or was this a departure from what you used to do?
It was a departure, but similarly to Dan, my family, I grew up on a farm and we had a dairy herd. So my parents always said there's money in muck. You know, it was one of the things. And my previous background is more fast-moving consumer goods, manufacturing industries, auditing across the world. I dip into toys, I dip into consumer products. I do quite a wide variety of things, which is fascinating for me. But I have always grown things. I remember I was probably 10, 11 when I got my first greenhouse that my parents bought me.
Oh, wow.
So I was starting growing tomatoes at an early age with lots of failure, but equally some successes. And now, I mean, if you ask my partner, we'd be in trouble. I've got probably over 100 houseplants and I can't even count how many pots I've got outside. But it is a passion of mine.
Your backdrop looks great. I love it.
Thank you.
So, Simon, you mentioned challenges within Peat Free. So what have you seen as some of the challenges for companies in creating a product that matches the quality of the peat-based composts? And do you think, I mean, you said you're really happy with what Durston's are producing now. So do you think we're getting there?
Yes, in a short word. I think we have to sort of take it back to peat in terms of why we used peat and or why we still do use peat in certain situations. It's stable. It's it doesn't really do anything. You know, it's a blank canvas for a manufacturer to be able to apply whatever nutrients and surfactants, etc., that they need to be able to produce it for a specific plant type. And it's very easy if you start with a blank piece of paper to then add in what you need. So that's why peat was very helpful and easy to utilize. Whereas now, as we move into the peat-free world, we've got lots of different ingredients that have different chemical and physical properties all coming together and then having their own interactions whilst within the bag or, you know, whilst they're stored and they're expecting, you know, a similar result at the end. And it's not that straightforward. So you have to really understand your supply chain of your raw materials. You've got to understand their sort of their properties in terms of how they're going to change over time and how they interact with each other to be able to make sure that that endpoint product, when it goes to a consumer, is going to work. And that's the challenge from a grow media manufacturer point of view, getting the right mix of the right materials and that consistency time and time again.
Can I just say, Simon, I really like that answer. I think you made that really clear. I think that was one of the best answers I've heard for that transition and why, you know, what the difficulties of being able to move to peat-free, you know, with the new ingredients that you're having to use and the different properties they have and all that side of things. I think that's really good. Yeah. Back to you, Kate.
So, is there enough support within the industry for the peat-free transition, especially when the anticipated peat ban, it keeps getting pushed back and pushed back?
I think it's very difficult at the moment. You know, Durston's has had to, specifically them, invest a lot of money in infrastructure, operations, and supply chain management to be able to produce a quality peat-free. And they've done that out of their own purse. You know, there was no support for R&D or anything like that. And having me as a contractor, you know, they're paying somebody external to be able to help develop their products. And they've had to do that because they wanted to. And when you look at, if we go into the professional market and looking at large scale growers, they get a single season typically to be able to produce the product, which gives them their revenue. Well, if they jump into peat free, you know, without all the knowledge and expertise needed, and they have a failure of 100,000 plants, their business could be on the rocks. So it's very difficult, I think, without having some support with legislation. I don't personally think that just having a ban works. I think you have to have other systemic changes added into that to be able to make it viable for all the different types of people that interact within the horticultural industry. And there are, you know, there's the person at the ground that's doing the bagging, there's the person in the retail shop that's trying to sell the plants. There's a lot of people that it touches. And at the moment, the education, I think, from understanding of peat free is not necessarily there. There aren't many me's in the world that have just geeked out on peat free. And so, you know, it's trying to get that information out there so that people can have successes. Because the biggest thing is to enable the industry to continue to grow. We have to produce good quality product, but we also have to ensure that the consumers know how to use them because it is different to peat-based.
Absolutely.
Most people blame themselves. When I started out, I would blame myself. I wouldn't think that growing media was actually as important as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But you're starting with the growing media, which is the foundation for the plant to be able to flourish. And so for me, it's very important that it might just be mud to some people or dirt or soil, but actually there's a lot more going on in that root zone, in that area, that's very, very important.
Absolutely. I mean, I totally agree with you with that. And one of the things I do, I give talks on how to use peat-free for gardeners, you know, how to get the best out of it. The RHS has very much kind of been leading this. You know, within the industry, there's a lot of people still challenging it. There has been quite a lot of time. So it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because I totally get where you're saying, but I'm also kind of coming as somebody who works a lot with home gardeners who are buying peat-free and they know that's what they want, that's where they're going. And there's a lot of people pushing back saying, no, we can't do it. But they've had quite a lot of time. You know, it's not like last year everyone was told, you know, you have to go peat-free. Do you think there is a legitimate agenda for a lot of people, or are people still being blinkered and just hoping if they keep complaining, it'll go away and the ban will just, no one will hear about it again?
I think there's quite a few different types of perspectives on this, to be fair.
Yeah.
One of the main ones for me is the commercial side of things. So we know, and the industry knows, we can produce good quality, high performing peat freeze. But that does cost more than a peat-based compost. So, I mean, Dan can talk certainly from the sales side of things, how difficult it is to get into the retail market if you're producing a product that's more expensive than an existing product that works.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I think retailers potentially need to look at their offering and, you know, really understand, are you making a choice because you want to be sustainable and you want to protect peatlands? Or are you just trying to sell product to get people through the door? You know, and that, I'm probably speaking slightly out of turn there, but I think the commercial side of things is the biggest challenge. We know we can do it. We've got the raw materials. We understand how to make the products and how to make them work because research and development has been going on for years.
Yeah.
And but that, from a retail point of view, that price point is a real sticking point. And I mean, in terms of the RHS and what they're doing, is absolutely fantastic. I mean, the large-scale trials that Alistair and Dr. Agavendra are doing are amazing. And they will come out with, hopefully, like a textbook of, you know, the rules of do's and don'ts for peat-free. And, and they will share that. The problem is now, today, we still need good quality peat-free product in the market. And the only way that's going to happen is either legislation comes in and supports other industries that are potentially taking material that we could use and giving it a higher subsidy, or we change the landscape of what we offer our customers, and we don't, you know, offer a cheap 3-for-12 peat multi-purpose.
Absolutely.
Because most people say peat's been cheap for too long.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I totally agree. Yeah.
You know, when we started, we perhaps didn't think about the environmental issues at that time, and so, you know, that's what we did. We've used the material that worked well. As we've got more knowledge and time's gone on, we know now that it's not the best thing to be digging up peat, and so we should really want to transition.
I think going back on what you said about, you know, peat's been cheap for too long, I mean, I really think that is, it's kind of undervaluing what it is we do, isn't it? I mean, as a kind of gardener, when I used to kind of charge hourly rates, you know, people would bulk sometimes and yet they'll pay £45 to get their eyelashes curled, you know? So it is with seeing kind of gardening and horticulture as a really important industry. Mm. And yet people will pay £20-30 for a plant, another £20 for the pot, and yet kind of bulk at paying a fiver for a bag of compost. So yeah, I think it's just turning horticulture around and getting it appreciated. Definitely. So yeah, that's a great answer. Thank you.
I've never paid £45 to get my eyelashes curled. But, you know,
that's... Well, that's where you're going wrong, Phil.
Yeah, I've not paid you to have my hair cut either.
So Simon's touched on the fact on two things. One is sort of consumer use of peat-free compost, and then and also more on industrial scale, so more horticultural, you know, nurseries and that sort of thing using compost as well, peat-free compost, and the difficulties there. Are you supplying both, or are you just focused on the consumer?
We've historically only supplied hobbyists. And that is probably where we'll stay. Although I feel now with the peat-free products that we're producing, the quality is there to move into the commercial market. I'd be fully confident of that. Yeah.
Right. And something that Simon mentioned also was the fact that you're getting really good results from that, and it's being sort of tested not just internally, but by external people are being testing it and achieving really good results. So can you, either one of you, tell us a little bit more about that and about the results that you're seeing?
So yeah, the products have all gone through what we call the P7 protocol, which is the GMA's sort of standard performance test, which is very laboratory-based, essentially, growing petunias and tomatoes. We've done three rounds of that now, and each time we've put in some competitors in there. We've also put in some research and development formulations to keep our eye on, right, you know, what's happening in the industry and how things are progressing. We've also utilised a large grower up in the northeast, who is the Dahlia grower, who wins awards, and I'm sure you probably know who it is. And they've used the material that Dan prepared for us with slightly different formulation, but very similar.
Right.
And that was done on a commercial scale. So we've there's many more, but we've spent a lot of time making sure that the trials are accurate, fair, and diverse. And because it's very important, there are a lot of different plant species and they all do like different things. And the years of, you know, multi-purpose compost, it's not really a thing, multi-purpose. You can't really produce a good quality seed sowing compost that works as well for, you know, a mature tree. So we tailored the range to make sure that there's, you know, a sort of a journey there. There's a seed and cutting, there is a multi-purpose, there's an organic, if you feel that that's what you would prefer to use. And so, yeah, the range is just, we've just tested it to within an inch of its life. But with that, because trials, often people say, oh, trials are trials. And what we've done is made sure that the supply chains of the raw materials are really strong so that the consistent raw materials go into the bag. That then enables us to know that each bag that comes off the line is going to be the same quality with the same characteristics within parameters, obviously. But that's one of the big things that has to happen. Make sure those raw materials that are coming to your site before you bag them go through the quality control process, they meet the specification, then blend them together, then double check final specification. And that then allows the consistency and you know, the consumer to get the same result time and time again.
Right. So thinking about those raw materials, Dan, maybe you could answer this. So can you tell us a bit about the ingredients that you're using in your compost now and how difficult you found that transition in the process now?
Yeah, I can. We have found it quite challenging over the years because obviously peat was very easy to harvest and very easy to handle.
Of course, yeah. But
going back over the last 15 years, we've developed a product called GrowBoost. And it's a product that we produce ourselves. We rent an airfield to be able to do that.
Right.
We bring in past 100 green compost and we blend with it other materials and we store it in windrows. And then turn those windrows every week for 10 weeks, which composts the material, heats it up to over 60 degrees. And then we double screen the material so that we're taking any oversized materials, which was very strange to a concept to sort of get my head around, because we were buying screened materials, but
you still got to screen it.
You would be amazed on some of the things that we screen out, or some of the sizes of things that we screen out. But yeah, we perfected that product now, and we're very, very happy with it. And that makes up one of our ingredients of our new peat-free mixes. And the newest one, which is very different to us, is a what we call grow fiber. That's needed quite a lot of investment in machinery to be able to put together. So we use coir. We blend the coir with shredded wood fiber that we bring in bales. And it's unique to us in the UK at the moment. And its uniqueness is that it comes from one species of tree.
Right, okay.
So we know its properties. There's not a blend of different woods that react differently, so we know its properties. So when the wood fiber is shredded and reopened from, you know, being compressed in a bale, it's got short fibers, and we need to blend the coir in amongst those short fibers to keep it open. Otherwise, it would flatten itself again.
Right.
So we're very, very pleased with that product, and it's light in density and light in color as well. So it helps fill a bag, and it's we know its nutrient value, and it doesn't, you know, weigh a lot like some of the other ingredients do.
Yeah.
One of the other ingredients we use is composted bark fines.
Okay.
Lots and lots of people do, but you just need to make sure that you get a good source of composted bark fines, and it's repeatable and reliable.
Okay. I mean, this all sounds like massive financial costs for the company. And again, there's not the support out there, is there? There's not grants that you can get as a company to make this change. So, I mean, are you finding that the cost is paying off, or is that going to be kind of a real long-term investment?
Well, that's a very valid point. Yes, we have made a lot of investment off our own bat. There was talk of some grants to be had for development and new machinery for moving into peat-free. But I mean, we didn't, you know, wait for any confirmation of that. We wanted to get ahead of the game, so we've made the investment. Yes, I do feel that the investment will pay off, but until such time as there is legislation, people are not made to buy peat-free, but people are not allowed to go back to the safety blanket of buying peat-based products, the investment won't pay off, no.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So this is something that, you know, the HTA and do you find the Garden Media Association are really fighting for, would you say, Simon?
There's certainly help in terms of technical information and how to get the best results out of peat-free grow media. But in terms of financial support, I don't know of anything that's, you know, really helping retailers or manufacturers. I don't think there's any grants available. I don't think there's any research and development, you know, cash that's floating around. I do know that the HTA had looked into a scheme that the government was potentially offering for farmers, but I'm not entirely sure where that's up to. But I mean, the main issue is we need to be doing this now, you know, to be able to, if we're going to try and hit 2026, 28, 30 for professional, we need the time to be able to get all this equipment in. Yeah. Blend the materials, and you know, it takes time, because the hardest thing is making a business decision to invest in something that hasn't been legislated against. You know, Durston's have done it off their back. Some of the other companies have done it as well. Yeah. But fundamentally, it's a risk for a company.
Of course it is.
And especially what we talked earlier about the large scale growers. You know, what's the incentive really for them to go peat free if it's likely to cost them more? And, you know, potentially they could get more failures. It's a difficult one. So I think certainly the main thing is start as early as you can and work with your grow media manufacturer.
So Dan, as a smaller company, do you feel it's been a harder journey for you than maybe some of the larger businesses out there?
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. We've had to make lots of investment in new machinery, like I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. We've had to buy more land to do these operations on. And we've also had to spend a lot of money with research and development and trials, et cetera, to get where we are now.
Yeah, and so those costs are the same whether you're a small business or a big business, really, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So coming to both of you now, what misconceptions do gardeners have about peat-free composts, and how do you address these when engaging with customers, do you think?
I think I would say it's more of fear. They've heard a horror story from somebody. They bought peat-free, their friend, their neighbour, and it killed their plants, you know, and so there's that nervousness for the consumer to transition.
Yeah.
We've done over the years with some of my other projects, quite a lot of polling that suggests that actually most people are literally just going for a price point. And they don't really understand if there's peat there or what peat is. Then, you know, they're just going to, they've chosen the plant they want and the pot they want, as we said.
Yeah.
But the compost is like the tertiary product that they purchase and you know, they just look and choose. So I think that's an issue.
Yeah.
I think what we did say before as well, people have said on the podcast before, is that very much your kind of older traditional gardeners, they're the ones that are really not into peat-free because of what they've been used to for so long, and that the younger generation or the lockdown gardeners don't really even know about peat-free. They're just, as you said, they're just buying compost. And they go on social media a lot, and there's a lot of kind of chatter on social media about, oh my goodness, you know, you'll find syringes in compost, you'll find Stanley knives and plastic, it's full of plastic, it's full of this, and koi is just as bad for the environment. And so much kind of misinformation and miseducation out there. How do you feel we can tackle this?
I suppose it starts with everybody producing good quality peat-free products. That's the key here. If we allow product to go onto the market that isn't fit for purpose or substandard, then that's obviously going to damage the reputation. With that comes the commercial question, you know, in terms of the cost being slightly more expensive. Again, without legislation, it's difficult, because why would you change from what you've always done if peat's still available? And why would you try something else? If, you know, as far as you're concerned, you're a gardener, so you're a green person anyway. You're growing plants, you know, you're not polluting the environment or anything because you're doing something that's natural. So it's a hard sell, but I mean, mainly education is needed to help people understand. I mean, from a green compost point of view, the biggest education piece there is what a lot of consumers have no idea about is the materials that they put in their green waste bin, composted, and then they buy it back the year after, either as a soil improver or as a component in the multipurpose that they're purchasing. Yeah. So don't put things in the bin that aren't organic and that can't compost, because they come from, unfortunately, us householders not necessarily recycling properly.
Yes. That's a real big one that education is desperately needed for. But I don't think that should be on us so much, on the horticultural industry, but it needs to be on, you know, the people collecting those bins, and on the homeowner. You know, don't put your plastic labels or your plant pots, or even worse, in those green or brown bins.
Yeah.
How about you, Dan? Do you have any kind of words of wisdom or advice that we can offer to home gardeners?
The main message is that not all peat-frees are the same. That would be my message. And, you know, it's down to us as a business now to get the message out there through various channels that our peat-free is, you know, a very, very good quality peat-free. We're very proud of it, and it's shown us excellent results. And we need now for the general public to try it and embrace it.
Yeah. And really, we need some legislation in place, don't we, so that the inferior products are just not out there for people to buy. Not quite sure how that's going to happen, but it's so needed. It's so needed.
Yeah, absolutely. That legislation and obviously the legislation for the ending of peat use.
Yeah, that would help.
There are also two other pieces of work. One that's completed that most of the manufacturers utilize, which is the responsible sourcing scheme.
Yeah.
So, and Durston's is a member. Responsible sourcing scheme looks at the materials that you're utilizing and goes through raters and scorers to work out how sustainable those products are. And there's loads of information on the website if somebody wants to have a further look at that. And equally, the Growing Media Manufacturers Council, the latest group, is some of the professional manufacturers are looking at producing a PAS type standard so that there is a baseline quality line. And unfortunately, though, this takes time, publicity, but it is important that the industry has a standard and then we all work to it.
Definitely. We had Steve Harper on the podcast a while ago talking about the RSS. So thank you for bringing that up again. Definitely. Yeah. No, it's useful. The more people talk about it, the more it gets heard. And then hopefully the more people start using it and reading the labels and understanding what it is. So do you feel that it is important for home gardeners to just use peat-free compost now to really start getting to use it?
The more you use it, the better you get at it. It's just like anything, you know, the sooner you try, at the moment, you're not forced to utilize peat-free. So, you know, get ahead of the curve, try different manufacturers, try different brands. Once you find one you like, you know, keep with it and understand the watering that's slightly different, the nutritional needs of your plants, the look, the feel, everything, because it is different. But that doesn't mean that it's bad and that doesn't mean that it won't work. Most of the trials we've done have shown that the Durston's peat free is better than 100% peat as a control.
Right.
So we put the 100% professional peat as a control and test. And we were getting at least 20-30% bigger plants than a peat base. So actually, it's an opportunity as well for home gardeners that actually you could get bumper crops, you know, and bigger blooms, etc. Don't be nervous. My main thing is try. And if it doesn't work the first time, look, this is horticulture. It's a lifetime passion of mine. You know, don't blame yourself. Keep going. And you will find success and you'll find a brand that you like.
And I like that, you know, gardening is a lifelong process, you know, it's every day is a school day. And I think people are just too impatient, aren't they, when it comes to compost. So just, take your time. Don't buy the cheapest. Buy, you know, something that you can trust and something that has, like yourselves, done all the trials and is really happy with the results. So, I like that.
So aside from the peat-free agenda, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges that the garden sector's facing right now?
There's lots going on in the garden industry at the moment. Obviously, the peat debate is a major part of that. But the weather we've had over the last season has really not helped. Certainly, our industry, our part of the industry, the growing media part, because it just shortens the season because it was just so wet and cold at the start of this year that the season really didn't get going until mid-April.
Right. Yeah. Anything else?
Well, as Simon mentioned also, the watering of peat-free is a good educational piece that needs to be highlighted because people are over-watering or under-watering. You know, they're killing their plants by under-watering and they're flushing nutrients out by over-watering. So, there's lots to learn.
It's education, isn't it, Keith? Because I also sometimes help on a complaints line. And one of the big things was I've been growing tomatoes for over 30 years and I've never had results like this. And as you were saying, you've got to change the way you're gardening. So it is getting that out there and not trying to insult people who have been growing for years, but just gently leading them in the right direction.
Where do you think the responsibility for that education piece lies? Do you think is it the RHS or is it the garden centres or is it the manufacturers?
It's everyone. It has to be a collective approach because we all come of it from a different angle. And the information required is different at different levels as well. And I think that's why it's so challenging. You know, I consider myself as, well, a gardener, but somebody else may consider themselves as an amateur gardener, but actually they've probably got quite a lot of knowledge, whereas another person has no knowledge whatsoever. So it's very difficult to tailor the education. And I think there's just got to be loads more information going out and helping people. Yeah. I see quite a lot of funny things on TikTok, you know, that's actually made it more accessible to some younger people as well. to get them inspired. And I often talk too techie, so like, I'm not usually one to be put in front of the camera because people are like, what is he talking about? Sometimes you just need layman's terms, you know, that make it accessible to everyone.
Oh, I think the way you've talked to us today is very easy to understand. I think you've come across with a
I've
really,
been in the years of training.
So, Dan, what are your plans for the future of Durston's? Have you got new products on or initiatives on the horizon that you can tell us about?
As I mentioned earlier, we've just recently invested in new land, which is an old industrial peat factory, actually. It was where the Fison's company used to operate, which is only 2 or 3 miles away from us. We've actually purchased that site, and we're midway through making some changes and developing the site so that we can use it as an additional factory in the future.
Okay. And it says that for develop just furthering your sort of manufacturing capability, or are there specific products and things in mind that you've got for that?
It's just we're already using it to produce our grow fiber product. Changed the structure of a building down there so that we can fit the machinery in there. We can produce the coir and produce the grow fiber, and we're raising the we're improving the surface of the yard space so that we can possibly use that for raw materials as well. And there's a building there that we could possibly repair and replace and put in a new factory for expansion. Yeah.
Goodness. And is your grow fiber, is that a patented material?
The technology that's used to produce the fibres is a patented technology, yeah.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So I think we're going to finish off. I think we've done lots of interesting conversations on peat-free. In fact, Pete, you don't need to do any editing for a peat-free special. I think we've got it right here today. But do you both enjoy gardening? I mean, Simon, you've already said that you love plants. What about you, Dan? Are you a gardener, or is it just you work in the factory?
I'm a lazy gardener, but I do enjoy gardening. I use irrigation systems, and I've got a robot mower. But I do enjoy baskets and planters, both winter and summer. I actually do like a winter basket. Yeah.
Ah, nice. And so do either of you have a favourite plant or flower that, however kind of rubbish you're feeling, that will always put a smile on your face?
I like cyclamen. I think they're my favourite.
There's been some amazing new varieties of cyclamen around. They just look incredible, and some are fragrant as well. Yeah, I'm going to look at those. But I do love just the classic autumn flowering ones.
Is there a reason for that, Dan?
No, not really. I just think they're really pretty little flowers, and I always put them in my winter baskets.
Fantastic. Lovely.
They always die when I get them, and that's not a good thing to drink. I think I overwater.
I was going to say, because they look so delicate, yet they're so hardy, but obviously not for everybody.
No. Well, even the experts have failures. That's for sure.
Every single tomato of mine got blight this year. It was a disaster. Heartbreaking. So, Simon, yes, answer favourite plant or flower.
Mine, I've only found it relatively recently, is a night-scented phlox. And I ended up buying about 7 of them. The flowers only open in the evening, and the perfume that comes from them can fill the whole of my back garden. It is absolutely stunning. So yeah, that would be my current favorite, but I swap like weekly. What my favorite one I'm eating.
Oh, lovely. Oh,
fantastic. It's interesting you saying about the opening up in the evening. So I was reading something a few weeks ago about it, but is during Victorian times, there was a fashion for creating a flower clock, which opened at different times of day.
Wow.
So it would go round.
That'd be amazing, because things like crocuses, as soon as they get a little bit of sun on them, they're right out.
But, exactly.
Yeah,
never knew it was a thing, but there you go.
Worried about you. You're getting more and more into horticulture. The bug bites, it always exactly. does.
Exactly. Anyway, I think that's a good place to leave it. So I just want to say thank you so much, Simon and Dan, for joining us today.
It's been absolutely
fascinating finding out about the business and yep. about your transition to Peat Free. It's been really interesting.
Yes, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at writeobarra.com.